Chapter 3, Fox Hill Bank to Wisconsin. I was born before I was an American. That may seem plain enough, but a man who lives long enough to see one country tear itself in two, and then see that same country knit itself back by force, blood, prayer, law, and time, comes to understand that birthplace is not the whole of belonging. I first drew breath on the 6th day of July 1831 at Fox Hill Bank in Lancashire, England. My father was James Bennett, my mother Sarah Higginbottom Bennett, called Sally. I was one of 12 children, which is to say I entered the world already surrounded by noise, labor, kinship, want, and duty. I did not begin as a soldier, I began as a son. Lancashire was the first country of my memory, though memory from childhood comes in fragments and feelings more than in orderly account. A child knows the rise of a place before he knows its county. He knows the sound of voices before he knows the spelling of names. He knows the shape of work because every adult body around him bears it. Fox Hill Bank was the name that remained attached to me long after I had crossed the Atlantic and put American soil under my boots. In later years, when others wrote down the facts of my life, they kept that place. Born July 6, 1831, at Fox Hill Bank, Lancashire, England. A man may travel far and still carry such words like a tag sewn inside his coat. I came to America about the year 1848, when I was near 17 years of age. I came to New York with a brother. The record does not preserve everything a young man felt on leaving England, and I will not pretend now to remember every sight with the clearness of a picture. But I know what it is to leave. I know what it is to have the old country fall behind and a new one stand before you with no promise, except that your hands may find work if your will does not fail. America was not yet the America whose armies I would join. It was a country still arguing with itself about what kind of freedom it meant. A boy of 17 may not see the whole of that argument. He sees road, wage, lodging, weather, hunger, opportunity. He sees whether a man can move and whether that movement changes his station. I had not crossed the ocean to be idle. From New York, I went west. I spent about a year in Dubuque, Iowa, working in a general store. That was before Iowa and Wisconsin had settled into the names by which my descendants would trace me. Dubuque was a river place, and a store is a school of human need. A young man behind a counter sees what people buy when money is short, and what they ask for when credit must stand in place of coin. He learns weights, measures, faces, habits. He learns that a settlement is not made by speeches, but by flour, cloth, nails, tools, seed, and trust. Then I went on to Wisconsin. Moundville in Marquette County became the ground under my life. I farmed there. That sentence is short because farm work needs no ornament. It is day after day of doing what the season requires and finding that the season does not ask whether you are willing. The land teaches a man patience if it does not break him first. In Wisconsin, I was no longer only an English youth trying his fortune. I was becoming a man with neighbors, obligations, and a name that could be known in a place. It was there also that my faith took public form. In April 1852, I was baptized at the Fox River, near Moundville, by the Reverend J.M. Thurston. I was 20 years old. I had come across an ocean and inland through a young republic, but baptism is another kind of crossing. No water, whether river or sea, makes a man righteous by itself, but a man who goes down into the water declares where he means to stand when he rises. I was a Baptist from that time forward, and if there is one thing in my surviving letter that needs no explanation, it is the manner in which I spoke of God. I did not discover providence in the army. I carried that trust with me before I enlisted, before the Red River, before the dam, before the charge at Blakely. When I later wrote to my wife from New Orleans, "Still I put my trust in God," those words were not borrowed for the occasion. They belonged to the life I had already been living. In those Wisconsin years, I met Elizabeth Ellison. She, too, was from Lancashire, born at Whalley in the Ribble Valley on the 9th of September, 1835. That is one of the tender facts, that in the middle of Wisconsin, among American farms and immigrant households, I married a woman whose first country lay near my own. We had both crossed from England into this new life, though not necessarily by the same road or with the same memories. Her father was Martin G. Ellison Sr., her mother, Alice Holker Ellison. They, too, had made a family in Wisconsin. Elizabeth and I were married on May 2, 1856. I was 24 years old. She was 20. I do not have a letter from that day to lay before you. I cannot quote what we said to one another, nor should I invent words and call them memory. What the record does not say. The room was not large enough to make the day grand, and perhaps that was mercy. A small room holds a vow more closely than a hall. Elizabeth stood near enough that I could see the movement of her breath and the care with which her dress had been made ready. Her people were there, and mine, or such of mine as Wisconsin and distance had left within reach. Enough witnesses to make our promise public, enough quiet to make it our own. When the minister asked what must be asked, I answered as a young man answers when he believes the years ahead will be given to him entire. I took her hand. She took mine. We promised before God what neither of us could yet know how briefly we would be permitted to keep, but a marriage record, even when reduced to names and dates, stands for a whole human hope. A young man and a young woman do not marry merely to appear in a register. They marry because they believe the future has room for them. For less than a year, that belief was given to us. Our daughter Elizabeth was born April 12, 1857 at Moundville. Her mother died within days of that birth. The sources do not agree on the exact date. My obituary gave April 13th. Her gravestone gives April 15. Find a grave indexes April 12th. The difference of those days is small to the record and immeasurable to the heart. What matters is that the child lived and the mother did not. Elizabeth Ellison Bennett was 21 years old. I have seen death in war, and I have seen men fall by violence, fever, and exhaustion. But the death that first broke open my adult life was not on a battlefield. It was in the household. It came where there should have been new life, rest, and thanksgiving. A daughter had come into the world bearing her mother's name, and the woman who gave her that name was taken from it. If this memoir speaks of war, it must also speak of that grave. Otherwise, it would make the error so many accounts make, as if a man's life begins when he puts on a uniform. Mine did not. By the time I enlisted in 1864, I had already stood where loss cannot be answered. I had already held an infant daughter whose mother was gone. I had already learned that providence is not the same thing as being spared sorrow. The child was Elizabeth Bennett. Later, she would be Elizabeth Bennett Shadbolt. Later still, through her line, would come the family that preserved my letter and sought my story. But before all that, she was a motherless baby in Wisconsin. A widower with a child learns quickly that grief cannot be allowed to consume all the hours of the day. A baby must be fed. A house must be kept. Work must continue. The field does not pause because there is mourning inside the walls. That can sound cruel, but it is also mercy. To rise because something living needs you is one way God keeps a man from sinking altogether. I remained a widower for 19 months. Those months are not full in the record. They sit between dates. April 1857, when Elizabeth died, and November 19, 1858, when I married Janet Hume. Yet I know they were not empty months. No month is empty when a child is growing. My daughter learned the world without the mother who bore her. I learned fatherhood under the sign of absence. Here I must be careful. It would be easy to make more of silence than the sources allow. I do not know, from the record before us, how often Elizabeth Ellison's parents saw their granddaughter, though Martin and Alice Ellison were alive and in Wisconsin. I do not know what was spoken over that child in the first year of her life. I do not know what objects of her mother's remained in the house. These are questions, not facts. But I know this much. A child born at the edge of her mother's death carries a story before she can speak. When I married Janet Hume, I was not beginning as an unburdened man. Janet was born November 8, 1839, in Hamilton, Scotland. She had come to Portage, Wisconsin with her parents in 1850 when she was 10 years old, after an ocean voyage of 8 weeks. She was 19 when we married. I was 27. She entered not only a marriage, but a household already marked by loss. My daughter Elizabeth was about 1 year old. Janet became wife to me and mother in practice to a child not born of her body. That fact must be honored plainly. Janet is not in Doug's bloodline. Doug descends through Elizabeth Ellison and the daughter Elizabeth, but Janet is in the life of the letter and in the life of the child. When I wrote My Dear Wife from New Orleans in 1864, I wrote to Janet. When my daughter Elizabeth grew, Janet was the mother she knew. In later years, Elizabeth remained close among the children of Janet's line. Families are made by blood, but they are also made by bread, discipline, illness, washing, prayer, and the daily answering of a child's needs. Chapter by chapter, I expect this book will come to the war. But the war did not create the stakes. It revealed them. When I left for service, I did not leave an idea called home. I left a particular household made from two marriages, one grave, a young wife, and children whose names mattered. By 1864, there would be Elizabeth, the daughter of my first wife, age 6. There would be James Matthew, born to Janet in 1859, Sarah Ann, born in 1861, Edward Robert Wilson, born in 1863, still little more than a baby when I enlisted. Janet was 24 years old when I went to war, and her obituary would later say, with the economy of old records, that Mrs. Bennett remained at home and cared for 5 children while Mr. Bennett served his country. That sentence carries a burden greater than its length, but I am getting ahead of myself. In 1858, when Janet and I married, the war had not yet come. The country was troubled, yes, and slavery was the great wound beneath every political argument, but a Wisconsin farmer did not wake each morning in the certainty that he would one day march in Louisiana. He woke to work. He woke to weather. He woke to the child in the house and the wife beside him. He woke to the ordinary duties by which a life is built before history comes to test it. Those years between Janet's marriage to me and my enlistment were not merely a preface. They were the reason the later letter had such force. Whatever I am doing, I think of home, I wrote in 1864. A man cannot write that unless home has first become a real place inside him. Home, for me, had been built out of crossings. From Lancashire to New York. From New York to Dubuque. From Dubuque to Moundville. From youth to baptism. From labor to marriage. From marriage to widowerhood. From widowerhood into a second household where a Scottish-born young woman took up a dead woman's child and raised her among her own. If there is any temptation to make my life tidy, resist it. It was not tidy. No family line is. The line of descent that carries this story forward runs through the first wife who died before the war. The surviving wartime letter was written to the second wife who kept the household while I served. The daughter who carried the bloodline also carried the care of a stepmother. The war story is therefore not one straight road from soldier to battle. It is a braid. I did not know, in those years, who would one day read my words. I did not know that a single letter from New Orleans would outlast so many other papers. I did not know that the diary I later rewrote and had bound would become a thing sought after. I knew only the duties given to me as they came. I had been born in England. I had made myself a life in Wisconsin. I had buried a wife and married again. I had stood in river water and confessed my faith. I had taken a child in my arms whose mother could not raise her. I had worked the land and become known in a community. Before I was a soldier, I was all of that. And because I was all of that, when the time came to leave, the leaving cost something.